Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2010.
So you all may know more about a particular hike and more about some history, more about Washington in some areas than I do, but this is a book that tries to put it all together. So I want to give you a sense of that, how I got started, how I found the trails, and I'll focus on a couple of specific trails that I think might interest you. So, and a warning that this is not a book that has 40 hikes within an hour of Seattle. This really does cover the whole state, so you need to be willing to travel, or you can just sit in your armchair in the winter and read about it instead of doing it too. My husband Alan and daughter Anne and son Peter and I moved to the Northwest in 1981 from New York City, where I had been living for 13 years. And we came west like many people do to find adventure and opportunity and wilderness. And this is my concept of wilderness here. To me, wilderness was unspoiled nature, far away from the busy streets of Brooklyn, where we once had a geranium stolen from our front stoop by someone, I think, who was starved for a sense of nature. So to me, wilderness here meant mountains that were higher than they were on the East Coast, where we had hiked the Appalachian Trail. The oceans were fiercer. Our first encounter with the Pacific was fairly strong compared to the white sands of Jones Beach, which we enjoyed driving to on a Sunday afternoon. And even the subalpine meadows were more placid, more pastoral than the farmlands and fields that I had seen in Indiana where I grew up. So Washington was wild, and that's one reason we moved here. So we settled in the suburbs, which is kind of a halfway place, I think, between the city and the woods. And I could walk out my front door in my hiking boots, which always felt a little self-conscious in the suburbs, go walk up the driveway over what Bellevue city planners called a social trail, down a hill, across the street, pick up a deer trail under some power lines, keep going through some weeds and cattails, and I would arrive at Coal Creek. And Coal Creek Trail is a 3-mile trail through a ravine. You've got Coal Creek Parkway above it on one side and suburban developments on the other, but you don't see them and you really don't hear them, and it's like you're out in the woods, just, you know, less than a half mile from my home. It was a wonderful thing to do. So I thought that I had left the front stoop in Brooklyn and found virgin nature out here in the suburbs, but I hadn't. As you walk farther on this trail, you come to this dark hole in the earth, which is a mine opening, and coal mining industry had flourished in this area about a century ago. This is what it looked like. This is the town of Newcastle, less than 100 years ago. And so I got a sense that if you look closely, more closely at what seems like nature, you'll find things like a locomotive turntable sign where a train had been through. There are chunks of coal and bricks from a brickyard still in the creek. So this was not untouched nature, and this was not a romantic sense of history either. This is history that does not look so attractive when you look at it so closely. So our family began to venture a little farther away from home in search of trails and began to see history in different forms. It's no secret that the Mountaineers have been doing trails in the state since they formed in 1907 and published guides to probably every single trail in the state. So, of course, we started with those guidebooks, but they would often include just a short mention of history. Harvey Manning would mention a pioneer wagon road through Natchez Pass, or a racetrack in Indian Heaven, which he described as an Indian racetrack. Looks like some familiarity there. And we'd set off to find them, intrigued that there could be that there might be wagon ruts still in the state of Washington, that there might be a racetrack that had survived for 1,000 years. So we went into all four corners of the state, where often just following a line on a map with just a hint from a guidebook that there might be something more there underfoot in terms of history. So this is a curiosity that's taking us hiking. But there's more to it than that. On top of a mountain, if you get to the top of a mountain, it's easy to think, in fact, that's one of the reasons we go, I think, is that you're the only person who's ever been there. And unless you're one of these people who does first ascents, which I'm not, you're not the only person who's ever been there. So Ivan Doig writes about this, and I quote him in my preface, this sense of those who have come before. So let me read just a little bit from the preface here. In his book, Winter Brothers, Ivan Doig writes of his kinship to James Swan, who lived more than a century before him. Swan was a kind of a jack of all trades, a customs agent, an anthropologist, a teacher. He spent a lot of time among the Macaw and other tribes, just seeming to find a way to hang out on the coast. Reading Swan's diaries, Doig finds himself in a community of time as well as of people. Doig watches gulls sail across his line of sight much as Swan saw them. Resonance of this rare sort, he says, we had better learn to prize like breath. So it's that resonance that I was looking for, too. And you find it in many places. This is the Elwha River, where the press expedition, supported by the Seattle Press, explored a north-south route through the Olympic Mountains in the winter of 1889 and 1990, or 1890. And the river has not changed that much. This is not the area that has been dammed, of course, so you get the same view that the press expedition got going up this river. In fact, there's a particular spot called Goblin Gates, a beautiful spot that Charles Barnes, who was on the expedition, named because he thought he saw goblins in the walls there. And I think anyone standing there looking at this can have that same sense of resonance that with Barnes in his first view of this area. So I became something called a field historian. This is a phrase I've read in Charles Schwante's book that's used in a lot of Pacific Northwest history classes. Talks about the field historian, the person who goes out into the field looking for history. So we're looking for slag piles from mines and wagon ruts and stone corrals from Indian corrals, camas fields, lookout towers, pictographs, all these signs of history in the field. And it's not so hard to do in Washington. We're a very young state, really, relative to Indiana or New York or most of the rest of the country. We're still, believe it or not, less densely populated than many places in the U.S. We have 3 national parks, amazing, and the North Cascades and Mount Rainier and the Olympics. We have numerous national forests. We have a national monument in Mount St. Helens. So we are fortunate in that some old trails used for centuries have been preserved in these areas. And they are still remote enough, too. The North Cascades, the Pusaten Wilderness, the Winnahatuckanon Wilderness in southeastern Washington. It's hard to get there, just to get there by car and to start on a trailhead and to get anywhere. So they're so remote that imprints of human history can still be found there. They haven't been trampled. Many people besides the mountaineers have undertaken this kind of exploration. Forest Service archaeologists are some of the best sources. People serving in lookouts get to know their areas very well. National park guides, of course, have had their feet on the ground for decades. And then I came across an organization of Oregon Trail buffs. And the Oregon Trail, there's very little of the Oregon Trail in Washington, but there's some. And there's a Northwest chapter of this group. And they introduced me to the remnants of the Washington Trail in Washington and to the Mullen Road, which goes from Walla Walla to Spokane. This is a group of folks who travel mainly by car, used to have two-way radios, I suspect now it's a cell phone thing, But they do get back into the Blue Mountains, and they find real wagon ruts, and they focus on a particular area of history, a regional area, and they really bring it to life. People like Yvonne Prater, who has written a book on Snoqualmie Pass, introduced me to Yakima Pass, which could have been the first transcontinental railroad route over the Cascades. Very few people know where Yakima Pass is. Anybody been there? Heard of it? Well, a clue, it's at the head of the Yakima River. That'll help. It's just south of Snoqualmie Pass. It's the Stampede Pass exit from I-90. And on one side, just to the west, is the Cedar River watershed. So then there's logging all to the east of that. So this is where George McClellan recommended that a transcontinental railroad, the Northern Branch, go through the Cascades if it was going to go by mountains. Ended up going along the Columbia River instead. He thought that would be an easier route. So. But you find these things, there are people who know them well. Robert Wood writes a lot about the Olympics, and he had a book on the O'Neill expedition, which went from east to west through the Olympics just a year after the Press expedition went north to south. So he recounted that expedition in detail. So this O'Neill Pass is one of the hikes in the book. So I discovered in this process that some of these trails, even though we have parks that preserve them, have been lost to any gentle use. Natchez Pass, which Harvey Manning described a couple of decades ago as endangered, has become even more endangered through use of vehicles. You can see this was a route off the Oregon Trail to Puget Sound. It was used just a few times because it was too hard to use, and but this is the original route through. But it became used as a wagon road, as a truck route, and if you try and hike it today, much beyond the first mile. The first mile is for hikers only. Beyond that, you're competing with trucks and jeeps and off-road vehicles and anything that loves to come up and down that path. But still. At the very top, you find Government Meadows, which is where the Longmire Party went through in 1853 and camped. So there's a sense of history there. It's just a little harder to imagine. And places like Kettle Falls, sorry, this is a fairly small picture, but Kettle Falls and Celilo Falls were the two greatest fisheries on the Columbia River before dams were constructed. And Kettle Falls is now under Lake Roosevelt in the northeastern part of the state. So this has been lost, the falls themselves, and this is a photograph of Colville Fishers on the river. But you can find remnants of it. This is a grinding stone, which was used for sharpening implements in fishing. And there's still a remnant of the portage road around the falls, which the fur trade used extensively. And when the Lake Roosevelt is periodically lowered, you can fly over it and see the outline of Fort Colville, which was a British fur trading post, and some of the outbuildings that are there. So it's still there. You can only hike about a mile of this portage road, but it's parts of it are there. And then there are places like Cape Disappointment. This is similar to about the same spot as the photograph on the cover of the book. This is where Lewis and Clark's journey ended at the Pacific. And even though the landforms have changed a bit from the action of the ocean, the ocean itself doesn't change that much. So you have a real sense, I think, of history here. So I want to give you a taste of a few specific trails. I'll take you down a few trails here. And I thought, even though there aren't many within an hour of Puget Sound, there's one that I find quite fascinating, and it's not my idea of wilderness by any means. It's the Duwamish River Trail. And this is a biking trail. It's paved most of the way, but a walking trail too. I find it a fascinating place because of the juxtaposition of heavy industry, and there's no place in the city more heavily industrialized and paved over than the lower Duwamish River, at least, and ancient history, because on this same river are sites, archaeological sites that have been discovered, you know, 2,000 years ago. There are stories told by Native American elders about the history of this area. So it's a great mixture of these two aspects. So let me read you the introduction then to Chapter 2, which is on Puget Sound, just to get a sense of how this, of some of the history. Isaac Neff Eby paddled an Indian canoe around Puget Sound in 1850, looking for the best place to homestead. Congress had just passed the donation land law, which allowed a man and his wife to claim 640 acres of land in Oregon Territory if they would live on it before 1855. Starting at the southern tip of the Sound, Eby passed the mouth of the Puyallup River, now called Commencement Bay, where Tacoma would grow. He scouted Elliott Bay, harbor to the future Seattle. He ascended the Duwamish and Black Rivers to Lake Washington and declared that the land between the lake and the Sound no doubt will be found very valuable. Continuing northward through Admiralty Inlet, he reached Whidbey Island. "What I have seen is no more than a mere outline of a great country," Eby reported to Michael Simmons, an earlier settler at Tumwater. "The filling up must be done at a future day," and fill it up the newcomers did. We have filled it up today. But there is one place on the river, more than one place, but this is the place I like to start, and this is the place I sometimes take classes, in the hopes that the tide will be low, because the tide does come up this far in the river, and that we will be able to see something called the North Wind Fish Weir. And that's what this is. Those rocks leading into the river are the North Wind Fish Weir. And there's a story behind that, too. So let me read a little bit more of that. When Isaac Eby ends up on Whidbey Island, and that's Eby's landing is one of the hikes in the book, and some of you may know his story. He thought he had found paradise, but paradise not without conflicts, which ended in his early death. But he is canoeing up the Duwamish River, looking for a good place to homestead, and he's following the way in to the Puget Sound lowlands, known to the Duwamish people. Their name, Duwapsh, meant something like going inside. For more than 2,000 years, the Duwamish lived in longhouses and camped on the shores of the river. They fished from large tripods and hunted for birds from blinds along the banks. European-American settlement followed a similar pattern, beginning at the mouth of the Duwamish and working upstream. Homesteads, dairies, vegetable farms developed in the fertile valley. Riverboats and then a trolley carried milk and vegetables to market in Seattle. By the late 1900s, this rural small-town life had been crowded out by industry, transportation routes, and shopping malls. Now it's even hard to find the river. But you can. Okay, at this one spot, North Wind and Storm Wind oral history explains why Puget Sound has rainy weather, how the glaciers retreated, and why this bridge of stone stretches halfway across the river. There are several versions of the story. An anthropologist, Arthur Ballard, collected these stories in the early 1900s. And the version of the story, one version told by a man named Big John, were of two peoples who lived along the Duwamish River, North Wind's people, who were the Cold Wind people, and South Wind's people, the Rain Wind people. So you can imagine who was entrenched at the beginning and who won out eventually. So North Wind's people, the Cold Wind people, killed South Wind's people and stretched this weir of ice across the Duwamish so that no fish could swim up the river. This is a theme in Native American oral tradition, is starving the people upriver by blocking the flow of salmon. But there was an old woman left of South Wind's people. She lived on a mountain west of the river, made baskets. Her grandson, who had survived Storm Wind, lived among North Wind's people with his mother. And when he grew up, he went to the mountains to find his grandmother. And together, he had the power, he's Storm Wind, to pull up big fir trees. And he laid some at her door for fuel. And they planned to fight North Wind's people. What they did is pour water from the basket she made and created rain. And that
melted the ice weir across the river. North Wind's people fled, and the salmon once again flowed up the river to Storm Wind's people. So this fish weir goes halfway across the river today. It's a very popular fishing spot. You will see people there when the salmon are running. This trail stretches from the lower Duwamish, at the mouth of the Duwamish, all the way upriver to Fort Dent, where it turns into the Inner Urban Trail. And along the way, these are carvings that depict the myth, the oral tradition I just told you, carved by Susan Point, a Salish artist. And then further along the trail, there is a story pole at Fire Station Company 53. This was carved also by a Native American artist, Chris Myers. So this myth is depicted a couple of times along the river. You get a real combination of early and late history. The Duwamish River, Inner Urban, I-5, everything goes through the Duwamish Valley in terms of transportation. Most recently, Sound Transit has been built through. And the house beneath the train here is called the Carasino House. This is a family, an Italian family, that lived in the valley and grew vegetables for Pike Place Market. And the house is still there. As Sound Transit was being constructed, they preserved the house. But for how much longer, I don't know. But you can get this, I think it's East Marginal Way there. You got the highway, you got the light rail, and then you have an old brown shingled house still there. And then at many places along the river, it's still, if you can find it, and you follow this trail, you could find it in its natural state. This is a pedestrian bridge in Allentown neighborhood of the Duwamish Valley. As I crossed that bridge once, there were some out-of-town visitors who were just in awe of the salmon jumping in the river. They just were very surprised that you could still see salmon in the rivers. So try this. I just included a section of it in the book. I'd encourage you to explore your own city here in terms of looking for history. I'm going to take you farther afield to a much different part of the state, because we on the west side are accused of not appreciating the east side. So this is part of Chief Joseph Summer Trail in very southeastern corner of Washington in the Blue Mountains. Blue Mountains are primarily in Oregon, but they cross the border, and you'll find them in southeastern Washington trail too, areas too. This is a trail that you may have completely to yourself. I hiked this parts of this trail three different times. Only once did I ever encounter another person on the trail, and that was a horseback party, which actually was probably the more sensible way to be going on this trail. I hiked one day 13 miles one direction, and I still didn't get to where I wanted to go, which was I was looking for Indian Corral, a sign on a tree. I'd been told there would be a sign on a tree. Couldn't get there, hiked back the 13 miles, and decided I'd find a different way to get there, which I did. And so the trail that's in the book is not that one, but coming the other direction on the Panjab Trail. But the remoteness and not seeing other people means you do see elk. I was having my lunch when I finally found Indian Corral, and there was a herd of elk who were bugling at me, and I just kind of, after lunch, I tarried a while, and then I started walking back toward them, and they left conveniently. And I saw a fox, too. So this is wilderness, but it is rich in history. This is not untraveled land. This was the home of Chief Joseph's band of the Nez Perce Indians. And I'm going to show you another view of it. They would come into the, they would come into this area from the eastern part in the summer. Let me read you a little bit of from the book of this trail. Joseph's band came up Smoothing Iron Ridge from the east, reaching Wickiup Springs. They went around Mount Misery, and I'll tell you a little bit about Mount Misery, and onto the high prairies. What became known as Chief Joseph's Summer Trail passed through the best huckleberry country with wonderful deer and elk hunting and some of the best fishing streams. According to Gerald Tucker, a forest ranger of the 1930s, the Indians traveled from spring to spring, staying long enough for the women to gather the roots. As the men hunted elk and deer, the women tanned hides and dried the meat. At Indian Corral, they stayed to gossip, smoke, gamble, and race. That Mount Misery that they came up was named by the pioneers. Bishop Norbert Blanchet noted that many American families coming over the Blue Mountains had suffered dreadful miseries, traveling hundreds of miles on the Oregon Trail, crossing the Rockies, and then facing mountains like this one. I drove up to around Misery Mountain. It's the absolute worst road I've ever driven in my life. And there are some pretty bad ones in the National Forest. But so I think it's an aptly named. So I finally did find Indian Corral, which was a sign on a tree. And I have this old black and white fuzzy photograph of it that I'm not showing. The last time I went back, however, there had been a fire, and the tree is down, and the sign is gone. So lost that particular sign of history there. After, you know the Nez Perce story. They were driven from this land. They had a reservation which was taken away from them in the late 1800s. And this fight over the control of this land led to the to younger Chief Joseph taking his people east and fleeing to Canada and being caught by the cavalry very close to the Canadian border. And they never were able then, he was not able to return to this area. And you know, you could see why you would fight for this land and not want to leave it. What followed Native American use was sheep herding, and there are a whole series of springs that you follow here, which are very nice. Diamond Spring, Basque Spring, Sheephead, Bear Wallow, Clover, Bullfrog Spring. So you can hike from spring to spring in this area. Very nice for horses, I'm sure. Or for dipping your bandana in, which is the way I got cold water from them. Okay, next one. So that's two ends of the state, two very different views of history, but both good hikes to try. The one, the Chief Joseph Summer Trail, I warn you, besides being a long trail, it takes a long time to get there. But if you want that sense of remoteness, it's a great trail to go to. There's a lookout there, Oregon Butte, which has people in it, still does, I think. One couple had been there for 10 years every summer. They would do the Oregon Butte lookout. So that's another trail in the area that is a good one. So what I hope you'll get from this book is my own sense, a heightened sense of curiosity. For example, anyone know what this is? Well, good guess, but it's bigger than a blaze. You can't tell that from the segment here, but this is a much bigger piece from a cedar tree than a blaze. Yeah, it's called a basket tree. It's a cedar tree. It's along the Klickitat Trail going up to Siskus Pass, and the Native Americans would carve the bark from this to make baskets for gathering berries, as well as many other uses. I had heard that there were basket trees on the Klickitat Trail. In fact, the presence of basket trees was an indication that this is where the old trail would be. Klickitat Trail is a 2,000-year-old trail, probably the oldest documented one in the state, at least that I found, that goes over Siskus Pass. It was used by one group to get over it goes into the Yakima Reservation now. And there's been quite a bit of archaeology done to establish where the trail was. Some of it's obscured by logging, but we hiked 17 miles of it that is still the old Klickitat Trail. But one of the ways they know where the trail was the presence of basket trees. So first time I hiked this trail, didn't see a basket tree at all. I went back to look for it again, and a friend and I spent several hours kind of examining every cedar tree we could find and not seeing it. We'd go off the trail. We found a grove that seemed to
to me, okay, maybe this is it, and I took some pictures. On the way back, all of a sudden, we see 6 or 7 cedar trees that look like this. It's clearly this is it. This is the growth. So curiosity will get you fairly far. You'll also, I hope, discover people in history who've become invisible. One person who recurs in the book quite a bit is Paul Kane. He was an artist. Roamed through the Grand Coulee, and when the Grand Coulee was surrounded on both sides by high walls, it's now Banks Lake. It's all underwater, backed up by the Grand Coulee Dam, so you can't see the Grand Coulee itself in that part. But he sketched some pictures of it. He also did sketched eruptions of Mount St. Helens. So he's this artist kind of following the territory and recording it in pictures. I also discovered women who were in the lookouts during World War II, particularly in the Olympic Mountains. There's a story in the book of Mary Johnson, who was part of the aircraft surveillance system there. So she and her husband shared, forget how many, they were 24 hours around the clock watching for planes that might be flying to Puget Sound. Didn't ever find any, but spent a lot of time in lookouts there. Oh, there's a picture of her giving her husband a haircut in the lookout. She returned, she's a great story, although she died about 2 years ago. At the age of 80, she went back. She and her husband had been in 7 lookouts over a period of a couple of summers, relieving other lookouts. And she, at age 80, did this Dodger Point, hiked up to Dodger Point, which is quite a hike. It's a long, long hike. She got a little bit of help from the Forest Service bringing up the water for her, but she hiked up with her friend to the lookout, stayed there overnight, and then hiked back the next day. So there are these lesser-known people in history. I think you'll also get from this, perhaps, I hope, somewhat of an unromantic view of history. There are bulldozers in paradise, and there have been many. Coal mining is not pretty. As we hiked up the Natchez Pass Trail from the east, I realized why it takes a whole team of oxen to pull a wagon up to a mountain pass. That's hard going. There was a reason that Indians ambushed a large expedition of miners traveling north along the Okanagan River. That's in the book, too. There's conflict that is often not acknowledged in history. And even recreation, our enjoyment of the outdoors, can muddy a meadow. We came across a truck engaged in the sport of mudding, which means digging your truck as far into the mud as you can to see if you can get it out, really destroying a meadow on the Natchez Pass Trail again. And I hope you'll also get an appreciation for the people who have really worked to preserve these trails, Harvey Manning and Ira Spring, people like Ruth Itner, who's with the Volunteers for Outdoor Washington, has interpreted the Iron Goat Trail along the route of the Great Northern Railroad, a wonderful hike, beautifully preserved and interpreted. I call it kind of the Lexus or the Cadillac of historic trails in the state because it's been so well interpreted there. And organizations like the Issaquah Alps Club, which is what got me started at Newcastle and the mining areas of Coal Creek, Washington Trails Association, these are the organizations that publicize and really preserve and keep attention focused on trails. It's a beautiful state. Some parts of it are still wild, thanks to the force of nature. This is a river that once had a railroad going alongside it, and you can see that the river winds in its ferocity of the weather. And in fact, let me read you just a little bit about that, too, from the preface. Not this particular trail, but the process of preserving trails. Washington's history is easily obscured. Densely settled regions feel like historical wastelands filled with urban condominiums and suburban tracts that have uprooted trees, rerouted creeks, and paved trails. Dams have flooded the pictograph and petroglyph records of ancient people. Public utilities, office parks, and shopping malls have interrupted trails. Such change supports more people. Such change supports more people, but obliterates the ways the land sustained life in the past.
And so I think we can honor the state by knowing its history. We must know how the wild was changed and why, and choose wisely what to preserve and how to live in what is left. So this beckons you on, I hope, into some trails. Thank you, and I'll take questions. Or be happy to comment on any other trails if you would like. You want me to talk about that one? Okay. Don't think I have any pictures along. Did that one. I've heard about that trail over Cascade Pass ever since we moved here, that was the best trail in the state. Have you done it? Okay. So I did it a couple times, did it as a day hike, and then with friends we did the backpack from Cascade Pass to Stehekin, which is now harder to do because the last 11 miles or so you could get you used to be able to get a shuttle, but along the road, along the river, but that has been washed out, so you can't ride that last part. There's more hiking involved. But it is a beautiful area. There's mining up there in Horseshoe Basin. So you can climb up to old mine opening. The basin is surrounded by waterfalls. Our waterfalls are hanging down into the basin. Camped at Cottonwood Camp. And then make your way into Stehekin and stop at the bakery, of course. And then, which everybody does, I think. And then down the Lake Chelan, back to Chelan is where we got picked up. That's a difficult hike in terms of logistics. My husband can testify that you have to drive 20 miles on a road to get dropped off, and then if you want somebody to meet you at the other end, it's as much driving as hiking there. But it's well worth the effort. Do you have any specific questions about that or comments on that one? Right. It was known as the Way Through. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I do comment in the book on, let me find just a little bit more to read you about that one. Just to mention some of the people who went through. I use Henry Hubbard Pierce, who was a U.S. Army lieutenant. He was trying to find out if Native Americans on the west side could communicate with those on the east side easily, so he was looking for a pass through the mountains. And he had been told that this, by Red Fox, chief of the Okanagans, that this pass through the Cascades would reach the Great Salt Lake, which is Puget Sound. He had a terrible time. He found it very rainy all the time and snow in August, surprise, surprise, and thought, in fact, that, he just concluded, no, they're not going to communicate with each other easily that way, and it's not going to be an easy pass. However, people kept trying to get through Cascade Pass. That was a proposal that this would be the first state highway would go over Cascade Pass, and it was on the maps for a while as Highway Number 1. But engineers with common sense prevailed and said, you can't do it. And there was quite an advocacy for it for a while. But instead, the North Cascades Highway goes through Rainy Pass and other passes instead of Cascade. I'm relying on archaeological study that was done by the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. They commissioned, you're probably more interested in how they determined that it was that old. Oh, repeat the question. Thank you. Okay. The question, there were two questions. First question was just to talk about Cascade Pass. This question is, how does anyone know that a trail is 2,000 years old? I think in this case, several ways. One is there's a place called Laser Cave near this trail, in which bones of deer have been found and a kind of weapon called an attle, A-T-A-T-L, that was used before bows and arrows, and that's been dated. So they found this cave, this presence, this human presence, which dates back 2,000 years. And then the rest of that, the trail is still there. I mean, some of the evidence is just the fact that it has been there itself, and then oral tradition from Native Americans as to how it was used. I'm not giving you a very good answer to that. my information came from the archaeological study, which was done when they were logging to try and map the trail so that they could preserve parts of it. And that's how I found out its age. Where is this? This is looking, this is Wallula Gap. It's where the Columbia River, the question was, what is this picture on the wall, which shows a lot of blue and a point of land. Wallula Gap is where the Columbia River bends west again, having been north-south for a while. The Snake River comes in right above this point. And this point of land here has a structure which was called Two Sisters by Native American oral tradition. One person renamed it Two Captains at one point after Lewis and Clark. They did go by here. They were on water most of the time. You can't hike too much of the Lewis and Clark Trail. You either drive it and see highway signs, or you follow the river. They were following the river. So they did camp in this area. Their campsite is under the water because the river has been dammed and it's much wider now than it was. So this is looking from a very interesting table of land here, looking west towards as the Columbia turns and goes towards the ocean. This has a lot of sand in the area, and Lewis and Clark, yeah, you're walking on a sand dune and you wonder, you know, how did the sand dune get here? And Lewis and Clark commented on the sand that affected the Indians, the Yakima eyes in particular. All the sand blowing and being around had given them a red-eyed condition, which Lewis and Clark treated with some medicine that they had along. I'd have to check my book to find out, but it was, you know, a very harsh area to live in, but beautiful on a good day. This whole area, of course, around Walla Walla was the largest city in the territory originally. So it's a very rich area in terms of history and of the fur trading history going through here. The Nez Perce Trail going through, which is what Lewis and Clark were following. And then, of course, the Whitman Mission at Wailapu and the mule trains. Lots was happening in this corner of Washington at the time. Okay, any other questions? She was commenting on having done the whole press expedition route and the connection between the press expedition and a member of that being asked if he'd like to go along on the O'Neill expedition and saying, not at all. It kind of evolved. It's a long story, actually. I spent about 15 years doing this, not all of it intentionally, you know. Probably the first two or three years, first 5 years, just hiking, and then began thinking about doing it, and decided I would. And I was doing it summers and teaching during the rest of the year. So it was just a few hikes each summer that we were doing. So it took a long time. But what better way to spend time, right? Right, exactly. Think we're done then? All right, thank you for coming.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.